thank you again for being here. Appreciate the songs that Brother Brent selected, especially this last one. That's been a favorite of mine for a long time. The notion of looking at the world around us and having our faith bolstered by that is a very biblical concept, very encouraging concept. Fits actually fairly well with my opening comments. As it seems like it's oftentimes the case these days on Sunday evenings, the sermon was prompted by a video that I watched. I try to spend less time on social media than I have in the past, and I try to watch fewer videos than I have in the past while I am watching on Facebook. But this one caught my eye. Maybe you caught it too. There was it's one of the smartphone kind of videos, and these two guys are out on this cold river, or probably sea or something. It's icy, and there is a seal out there in the water that's trying to escape a killer whale, because seals are the natural food for killer whales, and the boatsmen are trying to figure out what exactly is going to go on. And this is a motorboat. You know, there's a power motor there, which I couldn't tell whether it was running or not. But the seal is trying to crawl up into the well there next to the motor. You know, with people, seals don't generally snuggle up to humans, you know, but it's a killer whale. I don't know if any of you have ever grappled with a killer whale, but you can probably imagine the seal, you know, what's going on in the seal's mind. And one of the fishermen is rooting for the seal. Come on, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. And the other one said, no, that's not right, because we're human beings, and it's not right for us to destroy the natural order of things. The seal is on his own, the killer whale is on his own. It's not right for us to interfere. And so he kicked the seal back out into the water, where the killer whale grabbed him and ate him. That's not how the video went. Not really. I made the second half of that up. No, actually, the seal got onto the boat, of course, and everybody's really happy. And while we're watching it, we're rooting for the seal too. You know, you can do it, you can do it. And it struck me that we have a really odd notion of the natural order of things as human beings. What our role is in nature is somewhat confused. And generally, it has to do with us getting what we want, or rooting for the cute, cuddly animals, or against the big, mean monster companies, and things like that. It has very little to do with actually improving the world that's around us. In fact, the notion of improving the world that is around us is a very twisted and convoluted sort of thing. The pictures on the backgrounds this evening are taken from Yellowstone National Park. You may or may not have known that. And Yellowstone is a good example here. When Americans started to set aside vast chunks of territory, especially in the West, for preserves, the idea that was that we would preserve the natural order of things. And nobody stopped to say, what do you mean by that? We just assumed, well, we'd just let nature exist. But then before too long, nature starts messing up. You know, the grass catches fire, or there's a drought, and the native species flee to other areas, or there's a particularly large influx of predators, and certain species become rare and endangered. And our initial reaction is, we got to get involved. We got to stick our nose in there. We got to do something about this. And the bottom line is, we don't really know what to do about these kind of areas. And there's a very good case to be made that there is no such thing as preserving nature as it is. Nature is not a constant. It constantly changes. My views on you know, the Audubon Society and Sierra Club and such are not really relevant here. But I bring all of this up to say that if we as Christians, from different points of view, different aspects, different cultures, different political beliefs and such, we're going to differ widely, and probably the people in this room would differ widely on exactly, precisely what to do with regard to our interaction, or lack thereof, with the natural world. But the Bible does speak to the subject somewhat. And so instead of getting dragged into a big discussion about what we're supposed to do with regard to nature and spotted owls and snail darters and all those kind of things, rather, I'd like to focus on what the Bible teaches on this subject and encourage us to be united on that. And if we can be united on that, then we can probably agree to disagree on maybe some of the more particular areas. Okay, that being said, let's talk about the natural order of things, what exactly it is that our place is in nature. The first thing I want to emphasize is man's responsibility toward God, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with animals. We'll get to the animals, we'll get to baby seals and such in a little bit. Bear with me. But first of all, we want to emphasize that we as creation answer to the Creator. And this is a very important point because a great deal of the discussion, especially the discussion that takes place in academic circles, intentionally leaves out God. It is actually part of a much bigger conversation that has to do with our planet and our universe and where we came from and how we came to be. And the distinction, if there is any, between human beings and the rest of the world that is around us. I almost said the rest of creation. They would probably balk at the word creation. That's not something that an awful lot of people want to deal with. They'd prefer planet or world or whatever. We as Christians, we as people who read the Bible and believe the Bible, understand that man is answerable to God. And this involves, at the core of what we're talking about here, this notion that human beings are God's special creation. And this is really where the argument blows up. Because we're going to insist, I'm going to insist, I certainly hope that you would insist, that human beings are part of creation, yes, but in a very real sense, human beings are set apart from creation. Human beings are glorified in creation and above creation. Psalm 8, which we're not going to take time to read in detail, but I refer to this constantly, and I'm sure that you know the psalm as well. What is man that you have visited him? Why is human being so much greater than everything else? Why is it that God has elevated human beings to the throne of nature? And of course, this is a somewhat hypothetical discussion here. The psalmist knows exactly why that's the case. The Bible tells us why that's the case. And in fact, he goes on to discuss a little bit more about this, about how marvelous God is, that he has been able and willing to do this for us, especially given that from time to time we human beings don't act all that responsibly in our dealings with the world that is around us. This brings us to Hebrews chapter 2, and I understand that you covered this in your Bible class out here in the auditorium not too long ago, and far be it from me to try to nose in and tell people what they're supposed to believe on things, but this is very complicated passage. Now, for whatever it's worth, since we're on the subject, I'll tell you what I think it means. There is a reference here, obviously, in Hebrews chapter 2 to Psalm 8. Why does man that you remember him, or the son of man that you're concerned about him? You've made him for a little while lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor and have appointed him over the works of your hands. You've put all things in subjection under his feet, going from the middle of verse 6 through the first part of verse 8 there. This is the role that God has given to mankind. And that's what Psalm 8 is talking about primarily. And he finishes in verse number 8 by saying, in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. But now we do not see all things. I left out the key word there. In the New American Standard Bible, it reads, but we do not yet see all things subjected to him. Now, what exactly does that mean? Well, at least in part, it has reference to Jesus. That's pretty clear, the parallelism that he sees here. But it's also clear that it's not all talking about Jesus, because he goes on to say in verse number 9, but we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, so that he, by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. What he's saying here is that the things that we learned about from the psalmist about human beings apply in a very real sense to Jesus. He also received what might seem in the short term to shallow vision to be a lower position. And yet this was only a prelude to his glorification, that all things would be subjected to him in the same sort of way, except in much grander fashion, of course, as all things were subjected to mankind. So the story of man, in a sense, you might even say, is the story of Jesus in this particular situation. We are not yet worthy, he says in verse number 8. We have not proved ourselves to be adequate in our task? Well, there's no surprise there. At what point were human beings ever adequate in their disposal of nature? Exactly how long Adam and Eve lasted in tending the garden, that was the work that they were given to do. And as far as we know, they did a fine job. They might have done it for 100 years. We don't know. But however long that lasted, presuming, of course, they did a good job during that time, then the fall came, and then the earth was encrusted with thorns and difficulties and mosquitoes and all that kind of thing. And presuming mosquitoes are part of the fall, I don't know that I can prove that from the scriptures, but that's another story. So here we are with a messed up world, and now our task is much tougher than it was before. And it's still our job, though, to wrangle the creation that is around us. We have not yet accomplished that, but although we're working on it. Likewise, of course, Jesus, all things are subjected to Jesus as well. We haven't yet seen all things subjected to him either. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 tells us that. There's one enemy that is yet remaining. The last enemy that is going to be conquered is death. At that point, Jesus will have completed his task. It seems to me that's mostly what we're talking about here in Hebrews. That we are given this job of being in charge of the world. And in a very real sense, it is preparing the Lord to judge us based on the things that we've done. Because our future destiny, our next life, is going to be dependent on what we did in this life. Now, going back to Genesis chapter 1, we read the text as a group a few moments ago. And getting to this notion of human beings being set apart from the rest of creation. And again, we're going to meet with some resistance here from the people who do not believe in God, the people who do not believe that human beings are born with an eternal spirit or any such thing as that. The Bible teaches that human beings are better than the rest. That's not ego speaking, that's humility speaking. Because we were given this by God. This was not our choice. We're not greater than the rest of the creation because we're smarter, although we are. I like to think we are. In most instances, we are. Not because we have opposable thumbs or a large brain pan or anything like that. That's part of God's plan, I'm sure. But that's not all of it. That's not most of it. The main thing is that we were made in the image of God, as we read earlier in that text. Verse number 26 and 27. It was God's plan that human beings be different. He saved us for last. Everything else has been created, and much of it, especially the living part, has been pronounced good. Well, now we're going to make human beings. This is going to be different. He didn't say this about the plants. Didn't say this about the stars. Didn't say this about anything else. Only human beings. Let us make man in our image, he says. And that's what God did. Verse number 27. Male and female. Male and female human beings both are in the image of God. And the meaning of that, of course, is a very elaborate sermon in and of itself, which we're not going to get into. Suffice it to say, for our purposes, we are like God in a way that no other part of creation is. We bear his image in a very special kind of way. If in no other way, the existence of our spirit. I would argue there's probably more to it than that. But there's at least that. That we have this eternal spirit that lives on after this life is over. We are not simply physical. We are also spirit beings. Now, this being the case, if we accept that God has placed us in creation, superior to creation, we have to also accept his role in our lives as our judge. He's going to judge us according to the gospel that Paul preached. Romans chapter 2, verse number 16, that's the same gospel that we read in the New Testament, same gospel that I'm preaching. This is God's plan for us, that he would ultimately, through his Son, judge us based on the things that we did in the body, whether good or bad, he goes on to say in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. This is his plan for us. And I'm not suggesting that it's limited to the way that we take care of or do not take care of the world that's around us. But I would say it's part of it. The things that we do as human beings regarding our neighbors, regarding our neighborhood, regarding the planet, is part of the custody that is given to us while here in the flesh. We'll talk about that more in a second. Secondly, though, this is our primary responsibility. Our primary responsibility has always been answering toward God. Our secondary responsibility
is answering toward our fellow man. No baby seals yet. We're going to get there. Give me one more slide and we'll get there. But before we talk about our relationship with creation, the rest of creation, it's imperative that we understand our relationship to our fellow human beings. We see over and over again the relationship that we have with one another as being set apart as special, as primary, secondary only to our relationship with God. In Matthew chapter 22 and verse 37 through 40, you know the context there. Jesus is asked what the great commandment of the law is. And what was his first answer? Love the Lord your God, right? With all your heart, soul, mind. That comes first. Your relationship with God has to come first. What comes second? Baby seals? No. No. Love your neighbor as yourself. Your relationship to your fellow human beings comes second. Everything that God ever had to say to his people in Old Testament times, and I'd argue in the New Testament times too, is basically condensed into these two things. Love and honor God. Love and honor your fellow man. Obviously, there's a lot more detail than that. But that's it in a nutshell. Our welfare of our fellow man is our primary earthly objective. God being, of course, our heavenly objective. If mankind is in fact made in God's image, we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to our neighbors, to elevate mankind over nature. We are not doing any of our human beings any favors, whether in greed, peace, or not, treating them like animals, or suggesting that they should be treated like animals, or more to the point, I suppose, suggesting that animals should be treated like humans. I just saw, maybe you heard about this, supposedly there is some kind of monkey, ape, whatever, that was able to take a selfie. They give the ape a cell phone or whatever. And I don't know if it was trained, I don't know if it was an accident or whatever, but there's this picture floating around the internet of this primate that had taken his own picture. And of course this became all the rage and such. And now there are people who are claiming that this picture should not be used in this way because it is the intellectual property of the ape. It belongs to the ape, and therefore it's inappropriate for us to steal his privacy or steal his rights or whatever it happens to be. Well, it gets a lot more ridiculous than that, depending on which news site you're reading these days. It's the idea of quote-unquote animal rights. It gets pretty nuts. We were kind of subjected to the whole killer whale thing, Kylie and I, when we were driving on the I-4 corridor between Tampa and Orlando. There's all kinds of signs up there proclaiming the need to free killer whales, basically. You know, that we're in favor of freedom, we're not in favor of slavery. Well, I don't know anybody who's in favor of slavery. But I think we would all agree, I take that back. The Bible teaches, I hope we all agree, that our treatment of animals, whether it's ethical or not, is not slavery. It is not robbing animals of their rights, as we generally conceive rights. Animals are not human beings and should not be treated as human beings. The responsibility of God has to always come first, of course. When we're dealing with our fellow human beings, we answer to God first. We're not going to be pleasers of men. We're going to be pleasers of God, primarily. In Galatians chapter 1, verse number 10 tells us that. But there is an ability within us to balance these two things, and a need for us to balance the two things. God did give us both commandments, after all. So there must be a way for us to properly regard God and properly regard our fellow human beings. And I suggest to you that the best way for us to do that, not to leave the subject too much, but the best way for us to do this, to balance these two relationships, is helping our neighbors appreciate who they are in the grand scheme of things. To appreciate that they are separate from the animal world and not a part of it. I really chafe when human beings are called animals. Human beings are not animals. Human beings are humans. And the more that we can impress upon our neighbors the fact that they are separate, that they are alone in the universe, given a specific task, i.e. in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 14, 13, rather, sorry, 13 and 14, that this is the whole of the matter. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is man's all. This is the whole of man, This applies to every person. Different versions render it a little bit differently, but essentially all saying essentially the same thing. This is who you are. This is what you do as human beings. You are a God-fearing machine that either is fearing God or is being misused, one or the other. And if we can help them appreciate that, then we can serve mankind in the greatest way we possibly can. Now, I promised you baby seals, so let's talk about baby seals. Mankind is responsible to nature. The Bible talks about this, that we do have a responsibility. It's not the same as our responsibility to God. It's not the same thing as our responsibility to our fellow human beings. But there is a responsibility that is given to us as human beings, as custodians of the universe in general, and the things within our reach in particular. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, the original task given to human beings, to Adam and Eve, as we said before, was their need to cultivate the garden. Now, what exactly does that mean in an era that seems to have preceded weeds? How much cultivating was necessary back then? I don't know. Does that mean just picking fruit? Does that mean lopping off branches, encouraging, you know, exactly how much horticulture was going on? We don't know. Or how long it was going on. We don't know that either. But there was work given to human beings. And it's appropriate that this was what the work is, because essentially it is a fleshing out of the task that's given to us in chapter 1 of Genesis. That we are ruling over it, subduing it, making the world around us serve the needs of human beings to the glory of God. Now, it may not seem like cutting your grass or weeding your flower bed or tending to your ants, or, you know, whatever form that may take in your own personal world, that has a whole lot to do with God. And maybe it doesn't in that specific instance. But we are told in Luke chapter 16, verses 10 through 12, and this is right after that discussion about the unrighteous steward, the one who was willing to use whatever tools were at his disposal to take care of himself, to secure his future. And Jesus does not applaud the man's ethics at all, but indicates that, you know, maybe we can take a hint from this fellow who was willing to do anything that he could do to use the things at his disposal to take care of his future. Why don't we do that? The sons of light are not as good at this as the people out there in the world. The people in the world will do anything they can to take care of their future. What about your future? You know, their future may be $1 million, cover Time magazine, president of the United States, whatever. What's your future? Well, I would like to think that your future is heaven, right? I want to go to heaven when I die. That's my future. Well, what are you doing for that? Jesus tells us the things that you do or do not do in this life bear upon your eternal standing. Read with me, if you would. Luke chapter 16, verse 10. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Some rhetorical questions for us there. You know, not to beat the parenting drum too much, but those of you who are parents, parents of little ones or former little ones, you know what we're talking about here. Hopefully, anyway, our plan as parents was to give our children responsibilities, little responsibilities. Things where if they fail, they don't burn the house down. And they may have been successful, they may have been not quite so successful, a little of both usually, in these various tasks. Now, if you allow the child to do his own laundry, for instance, and you check in on him after a week, and the laundry is piled up to his ceiling in his bedroom, and every drawer is open, and there's, as far as you can tell, he's never heard of laundry detergent. You say, son, what's we're picking on the boys here, okay, because I've got girls, and they do their own laundry, so I don't want to cast aspersions on them. What's going on with this? Well, the problem is you're not taking me seriously enough. not taking you seriously enough. Yeah, this laundry is such a minor thing. It's beneath my dignity. Oh, really? Well, what would you have me do? Well, I think that you ought to put me in charge of re-roofing the roof, putting new shingles on the roof. That's what the job that I need to do. Oh, really? At 13 years old, you think so? Yeah, that's a responsible job. That's an important job. You give me an important job, I'll take care of that. Well, I'm not sure we're going to do that. You know, that doesn't sound like such a great idea here. Maybe what we ought to do is baby steps. Maybe you take care of the little thing. And if you can do these little things well, then you put yourself in position to maybe do the bigger things on down the line. Well, that's what Jesus is saying here. It's ridiculous for us to claim to be responsible and worthy of heavenly glory when we are ill-equipped to handle the glory we already have. You know, it may seem like custody over planet Earth is a remarkably huge thing, but in terms of heavenly glory, it's nothing. And certainly your little piece of planet Earth is not all that much. So if we're not able to properly handle the blessings that God gives us, and I'm not really talking about cutting grass here, but whatever possessions God gives you, whatever opportunities God gives you, if you choose to be wasteful, if you choose to be destructive, selfish, whatever, with these physical things, it's not just that people who litter can't go to heaven. That's not the point. The point is you're having an opportunity to be responsible, and you're choosing not to do that. You're choosing not to be responsible, and it's a comment on your character. That's my real problem with litter. I have a real issue with litter. It's not because I'm afraid the planet's going to fall apart. That's not it. It's not because I'm afraid the aliens are going to see little white spots all over the continent from space when they come to invade us. That's not it. It hurts me to think that human beings care so little about everybody other than themselves. That's what bothers me about litter. It's a character thing more than it's a cleanliness thing. And likewise, we have to be responsible in our custody of the created world, including the baby seals. And I said before we could agree to disagree on some practical applications of all of this. I'm not going to get into your personal life or your politics and decide for you exactly where the line of appropriateness is drawn. You know, is it okay for you to eat meat? Is it okay for you to eat meat grown in difficult conditions? Do you have to micromanage every single piece of chicken that comes to your plate and make sure everything was you know, free range and ethically treated and humanely killed and all that? If there is such a thing as being humanely killed, I don't know. Chickens might say there's no such thing as humanely killing. I don't know. But I think we would all agree that there is such a thing as cruelty. There is such a thing as demonstrating your lack of regard for decency, not for animals, but for common decency, that is displayed in your treatment of animals. And if you talk to the FBI, you talk to the police department, they will universally say, if you find a 18-year-old criminal, for instance, who has a 5-year history of cruelty to animals, that child is in a bad, bad place. Not because he beat up a bunch of animals, but because there's something weird going on in his head. And if you're that disrespectful toward a defenseless animal, then eventually that's going to manifest itself in your attitude toward human beings. And there's a lot of science behind that. I think that's probably a safe thing to say. Proverbs chapter 12, verse number 10, tells us there that, let's go ahead and read that. There are several of the Proverbs particularly that comment on our treatment of animals. And exactly how you're going to apply this is your business, of course. But the text says in verse number 10 of Proverbs 12, a righteous man has regard for the life of his animal, but even the compassion of the wicked is cruel. And this is oftentimes called up by the animal rights people and say, see, you need to have compassion for your animals. That's not really the point here. The point is that humane people, kind people, decent people not only find opportunities to be kind and decent and humane, they tend to compound that. They tend to get more kind and more humane and more compassionate. Where it's not just the way that you're dealing with your fellow human beings, You treat animals like that. Sorry, animal rights people, anybody who might be out there. The Bible does not proclaim how wonderful animals are and how cute they are and how much we need to take care of them. That's just not a priority in the Bible. In fact, if you read about a dog, which is most people's favorite animal, right? Generally, dog is an insult. It's an awful thing to be a dog or to like a dog in any context, pretty much. I don't know that he's being quite that disrespectful to the animal kingdom in general here, but the point is, a compassionate person finds every opportunity to be compassionate, even when it's dealing with his animals. The converse is also true. Even the compassion of the wicked is cruel, the New American Standard Bible says here. Cruel people find opportunities to be cruel. On their good days, they're cruel. Their kind treatment of their fellow human beings is what most people would call cruel treatment. And we know this to be the case. There are people who have regard for things other than themselves. There are people who do not. And kindness and compassion is always what is going to be extolled in our lives. That does not mean that animals are not our servants. It doesn't mean that harsh measures are inherently wrong. Sometimes they are, and the Bible talks about that also. Psalm 32, for instance. And again, I'm not encouraging you to go kick your dog when you go back home. I'm not saying that. I didn't say that. But Psalm 32, for instance, verse number 9. Do not be as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check. Otherwise, they will not come near to you. And there are many passages that are similar to this. I'll refer to Proverbs chapter 26, for instance, and verse number 3. A whip is for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of fools. And obviously, the animal treatment is not the main point here in Proverbs 26. The point is that it is appropriate and fitting, as we are custodians of our animals, of the world around us in general, that we utilize what might be considered to be some people to be inappropriate, mean, cruel treatment. And I hasten to say here, if you think it's cruel to put a bridle on a horse, don't put a bridle on a horse. That's fine. I have no issue with that. We're in an age here, generally speaking, where that's not necessary. If you want to completely, passively interact with the animal world, if you don't even want to swat mosquitoes, you can do that. I think you'll probably find yourself being inconsistent with that, especially with the mosquitoes, but that's your business. If you want to be a vegetarian, vegan, if you want to only eat fruit that's voluntarily surrendered by the trees, that's fine. Whatever. I'm not telling you how to live your life. But I am suggesting here that the Bible teaches that occasionally we interact with the animal world in a way that the animal world may not appreciate in the short term. That's part of our custody. And frankly, it's what God does with us, isn't it? God does cruel things to us sometimes for the greater good. And it's necessary sometimes for us to do what may be considered by some to be cruel things for the greater good. To make sure that the world properly serves the interests of mankind, secondly, and primarily that God is glorified. Those interests always have to come first. Now, before we close up, let me talk about why we're discussing this. Why is this relevant? Why is it so important that we maintain our standing against opposition as custodians of the physical world? When we reject the standing that God has given to us, essentially man becomes indistinguishable from the animals. Now, the hardline animal rights group will not lead with this. They will not get up there in the speech. Let me explain to you why you're not any better than a sea slug. That's not what they're going to say. But that is what they mean. At least that's the natural implication of the whole animal rights thing. That human beings are indistinguishable from animals. We're simply protoplasm that got lucky, that developed a bigger brain pan over millions and millions of years of evolution. And that's one of the great tragedies of the evolutionary theory, by the way. It intensifies this notion that you're not any better than the rest of the world. You're just smarter or more clever, or you're able to manipulate the things that are around you. Use tools better than the chimpanzees do or whatever. This is going to feed into the notion that there is no such thing as morality. And in fact, we see this working in Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through 20, as the world, the Gentile world primarily, rejected the notion of God and rejected God's morality had passed down through Adam and his descendants to all that would become ultimately the Gentile world. They rejected this. They did not go along with their ancestor Noah and the righteous ones that came from him. They decided to go their own way. And we're suffering the consequences of that right now. And there's a whole host of sermons that we could preach on this. Maybe one of these days we will. The notion of the world that we have inherited by rejecting God's role in our society. The easiest way to see it is in looking at human beings' role as custodians of the world. When you reject the notion that we are different from animals, suddenly there becomes no such thing as morality. And that's essentially what our postmodern world is telling us here. There's no such thing as right and wrong. There's no such thing as good and evil. You just kind of make up your rules as you go. One culture may be one way, one culture may be another way. Hey, nobody's right, nobody's wrong. You just kind of do what you want to do. Unless you're a Nazi, of course. If you're a Nazi, then you're bad. But other than that, whatever you want to do is perfectly okay. Well, it's not perfectly okay. And it began with this basic notion that we started with here. That we are the creation of human being, creation of man. We did not create ourselves. Similarly, there is no duty toward God. If we reject the fact that we owe everything to God, that we're put here by God, that we are a special part of his creation, we're elevated to a certain specific role, then we don't feel obligated to act in that role or in any way with regard to God. Acts 17, this is one of the primary points that the Apostle Paul makes on Mars Hill when he's talking to the Athenians. He tells us here, starting verse number 17, or chapter 17 rather, looking at verse number 24, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. He is the one who originates these things. And he made from one man every nation of mankind, including the Athenians, he says, to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appropriate times, their appointed times, and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. Going through verse number 27. The point is here, this is what God's plan was from the very beginning. That he would give us a certain amount of time on earth. It used to be a much, much longer time than it is now, in God's wisdom. But now it is what it is. And we spend that time in his service, honoring him, doing the task that he has given toward us. When we reject the notion that we are put here for a reason by God, we reject this notion. And we wind up doing whatever we want to do, which is ultimately, I think, the whole point of the anti-God movement, being empowered to do whatever we want to do. When we reject this standing before God, I suggest to you that the efforts that we make, and people make very noble efforts, and I'm glad that they do, with regard to taking care of the world that is around us. Ultimately, if you decide to clean up a river, or if you decide to protect an endangered species, or if you decide to pull the seal out of the boat and save him from the killer whale, you know, whatever it is that you happen to be doing and patting yourself on the head for, this is done apart from our relationship with God. It's done for your glory. It's not done for his glory. And so therefore, we're missing the whole reason why we're given the custody in the first place. You were not given custody of planet Earth so that you'd be in a nice place to live, not primarily anyway. You're given this so that you could glorify God while you're here on Earth. And if we separate the glory of God, we separate his purposes from our actions, this becomes self-serving. This becomes, look at what I did. I cleaned up a river. I did this and that and the other. The blessings that God gives us and that we are supposed to be custodians of, stewards of, they are meant to draw us near to him, help us feel closer to him. And tragically, what has happened is the exact opposite. God has given us so much that we feel independent of him and feel no need for him. Going back to Romans chapter 1, verse 21 and following, we see this departure, digression from the Gentile world, in the Gentile world. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of a corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. And this seems to indicate, and you can disagree with me if you like, but I wouldn't doubt that this move toward idolatry, this move toward physicalizing God or a concept of God, making a statue of a bull or a bird or an alligator or whatever your God happened to have been back in those days, that this is a work of Satan to make God seem a little less godlike. It's easier to make fun of a fish head on top of a human being statue than it is to make fun of the God who created you and gave you life and breath and all things. And the more trivial, the more frankly ridiculous God is made to look, the easier it is for us to reject God entirely. And that's the situation we have today. We don't have so much a problem with idolatry in the traditional sense, not in America anyway. It's not dead all over the world, but it's more or less dead in America. That's not the problem. We've taken it to the next step. We've decided that God's not just ridiculous, God doesn't exist at all. That's because we ceased to honor him in the purposes that he had given us with regard to the earth. And of course, this is what it really boils down to. This preoccupation with taking care of the world for our own purposes, for human purposes, separate from our relationship with one another, separate from our relationship with God, essentially is going to get around to denying the existence in the future of the Spirit. And many of the propaganda pieces that you see in this world are very thinly disguised references to that. This is the only planet we've got, take care of it, you know, words to that effect. Preserve the world for your grandchildren or great-grandchildren or whatever. Take care of, you know, the world you have. You're not going to get another one. Well, you are going to get another one, as it turns out. God's going to give you another one after this life is over. We believe that. And we believe that our work here on earth is not only important, it is essential with regard to preparing for that next life. But ultimately, that is what we are doing. We are preparing for the next life. Now, if we can present the world to our children and our grandchildren better than it was when we got it, that's great. I think that's part of our custody. That's what we were taught in summer camp. You know, you leave the place cleaner than you found it. That was rule number one. And we tried really hard, well, our counselors tried really hard to make that happen. And I think it's a good rule. I think we ought to do that. I'm trying to do that. I'm hoping my children do as well. But ultimately, remember, we're doing this for God's glory, not for our glory. We have to acknowledge the existence of the Spirit because we acknowledge that ultimately we are going to be judged, not just on this issue, but on every issue. If we deny that, we're denying the existence of hell, we're denying the existence of heaven, we're denying the existence of judgment. And there are many, many scenes painted for us, some figurative, maybe some a little bit less figurative. Matthew chapter 25 describes the two lines, the sheep and the goats, essentially. How literal that is, I don't know. We'll find out one of these days. But we're told very specifically there that the day is going to come when you will give account of the things that you did here in the flesh. And the good things that you did were done to his glory. And the good things that were left undone are a slap in his face, essentially. A rejection of his will. And we're going to have to give account for that ultimately. Some things for you to think about, anyway. And as always, it seems like when I get on one of these subjects, there's like Matt halfway answer one question and raises 20 others. I apologize for that. But consider this very carefully. And again, I have no problem agreeing to disagree on some points of application here. But let's agree on the fundamentals. You are a child of God. You are his special creation, different from anything that God ever created, and given a very special task. Some of it involves the world that's around you. Most of it involves your relationship with your God and your relationship with your neighbor. So be faithful in those relationships so that one day you'll be found faithful and, if not deserving of an eternal home, at least a proper recipient of heavenly blessings because of the grace available in the blood of Jesus Christ. Speaking of which, the blood of Jesus has been shed for you, and if you have not availed yourself of it, you need to do so. We haven't talked about that at all here this evening, but if you are aware of this shortcoming, if you are aware that you're not right with God, and you need to make yourself right with God, oh, why not tonight? There's never going to be a better time. There may not be another time. So if you need to make your life right with God, if you need to make your life right with brethren, if in any way we can be of spiritual service to you here this evening, please allow us to do so while we stand and sing at this time to encourage you.